Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tax season is here. The IRS begins accepting your tax returns tomorrow. And some of us in Michigan might be unexpectedly getting a smaller state refund. We're going to explain why on today's show. And just imagine if you could fire up your iPhone, swipe the screen, and reveal a beautifully written text from the 3rd century. Well, it's possible with a new app designed here in Michigan. We'll find out more later in the show. But first, the city of Flint has a $19 million hole in its budget. That news was handed to the Flint City Council earlier this week as the city treasurer presented the results of the city's 2012 audit. So where do you find $19 million to fix that hole in the face of already huge budget cuts, declining property values, and state aid? That's one of the many big things on the front burner for Flint's emergency financial manager, Ed Kurtz. Kurtz took over as the city's EFM in August after then-emergency manager Michael Brown had to step down because of changes in the state's EM law. Ed Kurtz joins us now from Flint. Ed, first off, what led to that $19 million figure?
In reading the audit, the auditors pointed out that there were three things that contributed to the $19 million. The first part of that was an inaccurate budget, a budget that did not properly reflect expenses and revenue. The second part of that was transfers from funds. For example, the millage that was allocated for trash removal did not cover the cost of the actual trash removal, so it had to be supplemented. It had to have an appropriation transfer from the general fund into that fund. So that, plus the sale of the Genesee Towers, which was on the books for $1.5 million, was sold, disposed of, whatever, for a dollar.
For a dollar.
So those three components made up the deficit. Now, the deficit wasn't $19 million in that year. It was 11-point-something, and there was a carryover of about $8 million in deficit from the previous year.
So what's the timetable? What you're searching for a plan to basically balance the budget and fill that hole. What are you looking at?
Well, this year we're operating with a balanced budget. Six months through the year, we have a balanced budget and we're on track. So we intend that we will get out of this fiscal year without any additional accumulated deficit. In addition to that, by law, we're required to file with the state a deficit elimination plan for that $19 million, and that's what we're working on right now. It'll probably consist of two components, and that's some borrowing and then some payment of the debt from our general fund operations. I believe the maximum we have is we have 5 years in which to eliminate that deficit.
Taxpayers or citizens or just civilians listening who don't understand the ins and outs of city finance are going to ask this, because I am. Explain to us as clearly as you can. You say that the budget is balanced. At the same time, you've got this from 2011-2012 with this $19 million deficit. Just explain to us who don't get it, how does that fit?
Well, the city, before the emergency manager was here, had deficits in their general fund for the last 5, 6, or 7 years. I know at least 2007, 2008, 9, 10, 11, and 12, the city operated with deficits, which means they spent more money than they took in.
Yes.
Okay, this year we're not going to spend more money than we take in. So we will get out of this year at zero or plus. Okay, so we will not be adding anything to that $19 million. But on top of that, starting next year in the 13-14 year, we not only have to operate a balanced budget, We have to find a method of repaying that $19 million over that next 5 years.
There we go. I know that you say you're searching for these ways of filling that hole and for making that up. And I guess people listening who are citizens of Flint are wondering, will there be cuts? Will city services be cut even more? What are you looking at?
There will absolutely be more cuts in city government next year because, in fact, we will have less revenue next year than we have this year. Okay, our property taxes continue to erode. Just an estimate right now, we'll probably have $3 to $4 million less in revenue next year than we have this year. The only way we can deal with that is by making cuts. All right, we have at this point in time, we have very few alternatives for producing additional revenue.
I saw your quote saying, you know, I'm scratching my head every night and every day looking for ways to do this and make this work, basically trying to squeeze blood out of a stone, it sounds like.
So that's about exactly what it is. We are, you know, to balance the budget this year, 120 people were laid off. You know, just a few years back, the city had over 1,000 employees. Today it has under 600. We're struggling every day just to get our work done. And in matter of fact, in many ways, we're not keeping up. We're getting behind in trying to get our work done.
We know that Flint, Michael Brown came in as an emergency manager in December 2011. So what do you say, knowing that you've stepped in more recently, but what do you say to people in Flint who say, is this whole emergency financial manager or emergency manager, is it working? Does it have our city on the right path? How are we better off now than when our elected officials were running City Hall?
First, let me say this. First evidence of that is we're operating on a balanced budget, which hasn't happened in the last 6 years. Secondly, what I would say to that is Mike Brown and his folks came in the middle of a year. The year started August 1st. They did not come in until December or 5 months into that fiscal year. The budget for that year was based on either getting concessions from employees or cutting staff.
Mm-hmm.
In the first 5 months of that year, none of those things had been done. So the administration did not live with the deficit plan that they had submitted to the state. They didn't negotiate new contracts, and they didn't lay anybody off. So when Mike Brown came in the door and got his staff together for that fiscal year, the city was already looking at an $11 million deficit in that year, that 11-12 year, and that's about where it ended up at the end of the year. Now, having said that, when you've got a half a year left, okay, and 90% of your costs are payroll, are people, the only way you can balance that, the only way you could have eliminated that $9 million that $11 million was to lay off about 250 people. Because when you've only got 6 months to recover it, you can only recover half, so you have to lay off two people to get what one person would get you in a full fiscal year. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so we would have had to, Mike and his staff would have had to lay off about 250 people at that point in time to balance that budget by the end of June. In discovering that and in talking with Treasury and in an agreement with Treasury, which was in writing in terms of a financial plan and a deficit elimination plan, it was determined that the EM should do whatever he could do to slow that down or reduce it, but not decimate the city by doing those kinds of layoffs, and then focusing on the 12-13 year in terms of turning the city around at that point, getting a balanced budget and moving forward. And as I went back and read all the financial reports, the deficit elimination plan, the communications with Treasury, it was right on. Everything that was said in those reports, that was the outcome. So they did exactly what they did. And again, you know, we would have basically had to eliminate the police and fire department to balance that budget over a six-month period of time. Even further, at that point in time, he did reduce the salaries and the benefits of the appointees by over $1 million. So he did do that. He also then either negotiated or implemented contracts with the unions that kicked in about April, May. All of those things took time. So basically the 11-12 year was already in deficit, and short of making draconian cuts, there was nothing that could be done to salvage it.
Do you expect, or are you getting signs, Ed Kurtz, that you will be getting help from Lansing?
In terms of money?
Mm-hmm.
No. You know, clearly we're not the only city in this position. All right, I think there's five cities right now that have EFMs, and there's many others that are now facing the same kind of difficulties. But, you know, frankly, within 5 years, all of our urban cores are going to be where Flint is at today.
Hmm.
I mean, their legacy costs, their the continued shrinkage in property values, state shared revenue dollars. Every urban environment in Michigan is going to be looking at the same thing we're looking at today unless some significant changes are made. The way we finance cities today is broken. Okay, we can't just keep putting the burden on the backs of the taxpayers in the city. We can't keep raising property taxes, increasing income taxes. At some point, we won't have anybody left living in the city.
We'll have to leave it there, but Ed Kurtz, we appreciate you bringing us up to speed. Flint's Emergency Financial Manager, Ed Kurtz, talking to us today. Thanks so much, Ed.
You bet.
And now a quick update for you on a story we have been following for weeks here on Stateside. Former Michigan Supreme Court Justice Diane Hathaway today pleaded guilty to bank fraud. Federal prosecutors say Hathaway and her husband transferred a debt-free Florida home to a relative so they'd qualify to short sell a home in Grosse Pointe Park that carried a big mortgage. After they unloaded that Michigan property in a 2011 short sale, the Florida property was then transferred back to them. Hathaway faces up to 18 months in prison under a deal with prosecutors. Her lawyer, Steve Fishman, says the term should be lower.
If this isn't enough, what is? You tell me. A felony conviction for a person who was a lawyer and was a judge on a short sale that the bank would have approved anyway, where they get every dollar back? Isn't this enough?
Hathaway officially resigned from the state's highest court last week. Governor Snyder said he is taking suggestions from his staff and current justices of the high court as he considers her replacement. Still to come, it may not be good news to you, but it is true. Tax season is nearly upon us. We'll check in on the changes to your state income taxes and find out why you might be getting a smaller refund from Lansing this year. And we get the latest on the controversy over Belle Isle. Just who should take over that little island in the middle of the Detroit River? That story in 20 minutes. You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you have not yet tackled your 2012 state tax returns, brace yourselves. Lansing may have an unhappy surprise for some of you, smaller tax refunds. Detroit Free Press financial writer Susan Tompor has been writing about this, and she joins us now. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Yeah, it's not going to be fun, is it? You know, some of this was very well publicized last year when the state was restructuring the tax code and, you know, making some breaks available to attract business here and keep business. But people obviously don't remember those things until, you know, you get a refund check and you say, what?
What happened?
Exactly. So it's not new news, but it's going to be new news to some people.
So this was the huge tax overhaul package. There was $1.4 billion in additional income taxes and then that $1.7 billion in business tax cuts. And as you pointed out, Susan, this was from Governor Snyder's belief you needed to attract business, create jobs, all of that. But that shortfall then had to be made up. So I'm wondering, is it possible to say who is most likely to bear this burden?
Well, there's a couple different areas. You know, it's going to depend on which credits you were getting and some of the different things. So it looks like there's going to be a lot of taxpayers that are going to notice something. So maybe the best way to address that is break out maybe some of these tax credits that you won't be seeing. If you had the Michigan homestead property tax, the state of Michigan sent out 500,000 postcards to warn people in late December that this tax break has changed. The full credit is $1,200, but there are some new numbers that are very important that are going to phase some people out of this credit. The homestead credit would vanish if the total household income resources are more than $50,000, and that's a pretty big drop from the old limit, which was more than $82,000. And the other twist is, and this one you might understand, you might not, but the credit is not going to be available at all if your home has a taxable value of more than $135,000. Now, the idea here is this is a refundable tax credit, meaning that, you know, it does help people with lower income. And you're saying, well, how do they, you know, be in a $135,000 home? Well, obviously some seniors could be in that condition, right? You know,
right.
Their home increased in value, maybe in a nicer area. So those credits do help people a lot, and you do have to prepare for the possibility. For some lower income families, we can say this group will definitely be hit, and it that is going to be a little bit harder. This Michigan Earned Income Tax Credit, it was not a credit that was around forever. I can't remember when it came into play, but it did come into play a couple years ago. Now the state is scaling back on it. Mm-hmm. Every state doesn't offer one of these earned income tax credits, but our credit's being reduced from 20% to 6%.
That's a big hit, isn't it?
Huge hit, because if you got $900 under the old system, you might be getting a little close to $300 under this new system. And that's if you qualify for a federal earned income tax credit. So, you know, that's where it starts. Then you get 6% of that federal earned income credit instead of 20. And that is going to hurt, you know, some families. We talk to people who are working. Typically, the earned income tax credit, again, it's a refundable credit, meaning that you don't have to pay taxes to get it. So this is a boost for some folks who you know, are having trouble paying their bills. So you're going from paycheck to paycheck, and you are working. It is a, you know, you do have to work, but this does help some people. So, you know, that's not going to be terribly exciting. And I know a lot of the folks that do taxpayer assistance are preparing when they talk with people to do those returns to maybe help them understand, you know, well, this credit isn't here anymore. So maybe that's why you're going to be a couple $100 short. And again, you have to realize this is people who probably need that couple $100.
Yes. See, it's not falling on someone that can say, "Well, I can roll with that."
Right. I'm going to eat out a little less. You know?
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Won't buy those shoes. You know, it is going to maybe hit some families, maybe some kids. So there is some talk in Lansing. I guess there might be some negotiations involving that tax credit with the roads, but who knows? You know, that's down the line.
Doesn't change anything right now as people are filling out their returns for 2012.
No. And, you know, another thing that people were used to and maybe don't know that they don't get anymore, but if you had given to a homeless shelter in the past, you know, where they you had gotten a special break on the state income tax, those donations that you made last year, you're not going to be getting that special break. So,
and food banks as well, and community foundations.
Right, right.
That's an interesting thing. As I looked at that, Susan, I wondered if would homeless shelters and food banks and some of these community foundations, do you think they could be hurt by the loss of those tax credits?
Well, they certainly were saying that, you know, that was going to be the case. I don't know how much, you know, giving was cut back. You know, last year, I think some giving might have been cut back, too, because the federal tax rules were going to change, and some people were advising not to give as much because if you're going to have a higher rate. So it might be hard to determine, you know, if giving was cut back, you know, why people did do so. But that Michigan Credit for Charitable Gifts, that was one that was given to public institutions, you know, and it was a pretty good credit, but you're not going to get that as well. And the breaks aren't as good for if you have kids under 18, you know, you're giving back a little. I think the way we calculated that was $25 a kid or something. You know, so I told my son, hey, you owe me $25.
Now, by the way, if you're just joining us, we are talking with Detroit Free Press financial writer Susan Tompor about the changes that came in with the big state tax overhaul package, changes that were signed into law a while ago, way back, but now it's time to actually see what it means on your tax return. Susan Tompor, I also noticed college tuition and fees for people who are writing those checks. We've lost that tax credit.
Exactly. So that's another one. And the home heating credit, you know, might be a little bit lower if a person's 65 or older and they receive unemployment benefits and claim the standard allowance. There's also a change in the unemployment compensation one.
Yes, the exemptions, yes.
Right. That continues to be taxable in Michigan, but there's no longer a special exemption for taxpayers where their unemployment compensation exceeds 50% or more of their adjusted gross income. Again, this is all, you know, little stuff that, you know, probably nobody even knew that this tax break was there. You know how some of these tax breaks are. You turn in your returns and do the stuff and you get your refund and you
right.
don't even know where it came from.
Right.
But this is one of those credits that in the past they would have been allowed an additional exemption so that no more than 50% of their unemployment benefits were taxed. And that's going to change. And, of course, we have the significant changes regarding pensions. in the Michigan tax rules here. For taxpayers born in 1945 or earlier, it's important to know that there's no change in that Michigan income tax law regarding pensions. But for others, you know, born in 46 and after, the rules are pretty complicated, and if you're born between 46 and 52, there's one set of rules, and there are rules for those born in 53 and after, and it can get pretty confusing really fast, so it's good to talk to an expert on that one. Public pensions are going to be no longer exempt, but that military breaks are still in there. So
they haven't hit that.
Right. So if you've got a military pension, I know I had an email from a gentleman who said he wanted to retire in Michigan, was worried about his military pension, and, you know, we checked into that, and one of our experts says, you know, pack up that moving van, retire here in Michigan, don't be afraid. So
now the contributions to medical savings accounts, a lot of folks do that. What's changed there?
What's changed there, you're not going to be able to contribute as much, and it is a little bit trickier. So that's going to be something that you're going to do when you deal with your payroll. You know, when you contribute through payroll, you may not be able to contribute as much as you used to. And the bad thing about those is some people do not collect on them. You know, they don't realize what they can and cannot collect on. And you should pretty much research that, because save your receipts, because a lot of these things that you normally buy, you know, may have some sort of a break to them. A lot of people got confused when they said the drugs, you needed a prescription for certain drugs. While that was true to take the tax break, there are other things that you can do, purchase, you know, like some things that you need that you don't need a prescription for. And you can research that online. There are a few websites that, you know, actually even sell these products, which is kind of crazy. You know, I don't know the pricing on that. You know, maybe it's a good price, maybe it's not. But it gives you a good idea of, well, if I bought this, this is a receipt, and I can file that to get the money. Because you don't want to lose that money in that account. And it's one of those use it or lose it type things. And if you know, some people think, oh, December 31, that went and came and went, and I didn't use everything. No, sometimes it's March 15th. So check with your employer as to when you can actually file for this stuff and when you can actually spend those medical saving account dollars. There's some wiggle room. Some employers offer more than others. Depends on how they structure it. They have an ability to give you a little more wiggle room, and it's best to just check with your employer.
Susan, as we talk about these changes, these myriad changes, it seems that the more vulnerable taxpayers, seniors and middle to lower level income earners, seem to be bearing the brunt. Is that a fair observation?
Well, they certainly feel like it.
Okay.
You know, I think they certainly feel like it. We talked with some seniors who said, you know, they're taking our money away from us. You know, it is going to be a bit of a brunt. How much is all going to depend on your individual situation, but certainly the seniors feel that way. But again, if you're born before 1945 or earlier and your pension is still not taxed, that's a pretty good break.
Okay.
You know, there's nothing wrong with that tax break.
And it sounds like the takeaway from all of this is to get the professional help of someone who understands all of this, because there's so much shifting and so many ins and outs.
I think it is. You know, I've worked with the Accounting Aid Society for the lower income people, and have gone to some of their sessions, you know, watch them work with the lower income people. And I certainly think that if you're in a lower income group and you qualify, that's worth looking into. I know the Michigan Accounting Aid Society works on this. The Michigan CPAs do a lot of volunteering. That's definitely worth it, because you don't want to. The IRS has warned against, you know, people who do commit fraud in this area, too. So that's an area you want to stay away from. I do think it's good to get some help. There's also some free tax services through the IRS. You know, you can do those online. Sometimes that works. You just got to give yourself a lot of time, you know.
And the other thing that I really got when I was going through, I remember the morning that I read your story in the Free Press, be prepared for smaller Michigan tax refunds. I think your advice, do not mentally spend that tax refund yet, from Lansing.
You know, and that was really what motivated me, to be honest with you, to write that piece. Some people might say, well, of course we knew these breaks were going away because this was well publicized. But when I talked with people who do work with people on taxes, so often people will say, I got $600 back last year. from the state.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to expect $600 back this year. That's fine, but if it's not going to be $600, that's not going to cover the car repair. That won't cover the rent. I'm not trying to be harsh here, but if it's not there and it won't be there, I certainly wouldn't want someone thinking, oh, where's that extra $400 going to come from? It's better to know.
Susan, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And here at Stateside, we really love hearing from you. What stories, issues, or people do you want us to focus on? Let us know. We're online at michiganradio.org. All you have to do is click on the link that says Stateside. And we're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Today's mild, rainy weather certainly might affect winter sports in Michigan, but it'll get cold again, and you cannot get through winter here, it seems, without having at least some awareness that skiing plays a big part in wintertime activities in Michigan, bringing in real money. And you may be surprised to discover Michigan is a real power player when it comes to skiing in the United States. Mickey McWilliams is the executive director of the Michigan Snow Sports Industries Association, the MSIA, and she joins us now from Clarkston. Hi, Mickey.
Hi.
So tell us, how does Michigan rank in terms of ability to find a place to ski?
Well, very interesting. No other place in the United States can you live within 2 hours of a ski area. We do that here. So no matter where you are, skiing is very, very accessible. You're within 2 hours of a ski area in Michigan.
And are we at the top? Are we tops in the nation?
We are tied with New York as far as number of ski areas. But in New York, there are places that you can live that you have to drive longer than 2 hours to get to a ski area, and that's not true in Michigan.
And I'm actually very surprised. So we actually outrank Colorado and Vermont in terms of numbers of ski areas.
That's true. That's true. They have, some of theirs are a little bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But we have more.
But we have more.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the impact the snow sports industry has here in Michigan.
Well, it's important to note that winter in Michigan is a really, really big time for travel. Sometimes people don't realize that we travel in Michigan for recreational travel is about one-third of the $17.7 billion industry. So, you know, it's a big deal traveling in the wintertime.
Certainly, there have been a lot of headlines, Mickey McWilliams, from scientists, NASA scientists, for instance, telling us 2012 was the ninth warmest globally since they started keeping records in 1880. And so many scientists are pointing to a warming pattern that really has continued since the middle of the 20th century. What has that meant to ski resorts and skiing in our state?
Well, it's really important to note that that our ski areas have adapted. They've done a number of things. One is that they have more and better snowmaking equipment now, and they invest continually every year in new equipment that makes snow at warmer temperatures and makes more snow, is more efficient. And then the other thing that ski areas have done is they're not relying just on skiing. They have other activities as well. Snowshoeing, there's indoor water parks, all sorts of other activities. So when you go to a ski area, you can, you know, you're going for a whole experience. It might not just be downhill skiing. It might be all sorts of different things.
Now, speaking of the better technology and better snowmaking, at what temperature can they make snow? And the reason I ask this is my husband and I were driving up to the Traverse City area a couple of weekends ago, and it was a pretty mild weekend. It was that Saturday when we really had mild temperatures. It was in the mid to upper 50s. And as we drove up I-75 and went by Mount Holly, he said, gee, I wonder if they're skiing. And it occurred to me, I would have bet not, but at what point can they make snow?
Well, you know, really, the best snow is made at 28 degrees and lower.
Mm-hmm.
You can make snow at higher temperatures, but it doesn't make as good of snow as it does when it's below 28 and below. Humidity plays a factor, too. If it's less humid, you can make snow at higher temperatures. The less humidity in the air, the better the snowmaking is.
Mickey McWilliams is the executive director of the MSIA, the Michigan Snow Sports Industries Association. Mickey, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Still to come, the very old meets the very new. There's a new app developed right here in Michigan that will let you scroll through old texts. We're talking ancient. Think 3rd century. We'll have that story coming up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Earlier today, the Detroit City Council took up the question of whether to approve a lease agreement that would have turned Belle Isle into a state park for at least 30 years, with the state investing millions in upgrades to Belle Isle and assuming the $6 million annual tab for upkeep of the island in the middle of the Detroit River. After an energetic and passionate public comment period this morning, the council decided not to vote on the lease agreement. That prompted a speedy announcement from Governor Snyder's office. They're taking the deal off the table. Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter Sarah Swick covered the meeting at the Coleman A. Young Municipal Building in downtown Detroit. She joins us now. Sarah, what kinds of arguments were being made against the Belle Isle lease deal? Was there a lot of opposition?
Sure, there was. There were several points brought up, which I think were legitimate points. There's a clause in the state constitution that talks about a municipality not being able to lend credit to any other public or private institution, and that's been interpreted as saying they need to basically get fair market value for anything that they are, you know, exchanging any sort of deal they enter into. So it could be argued that since the lease was, the city was not going to be compensated for Belle Isle other than the state taking it over the state park and maintaining and keeping it up, that could violate that provision of the Constitution. There were questions about the deed even, which is very old. I think it dates back to the 1870s of when that was actually deeded over to the city and even finding it and whether you can execute a lease with that. But really the main sort of font of the opposition was seemed very emotional, that people were very, certain core group of Detroiters were very opposed to the idea of the state taking away what they consider to be something that has belonged to Detroiters for well over a century and has always been sort of, you know, what people are calling the city's backyard. So there was just kind of that emotional idea. And I think also some of the opposition was centered around the fact that if Belle Isle were to become a state park, there would be a fee involved. It would be $11 per year, and people would get a state park passport that would also open all the other state parks up to them on an annual basis. And also, if you came on foot or by bike or on public transportation, you could still get in for free. But there seemed to be some misperception that this would be a charge for every time someone went on to the island. And also some people were just opposed to the idea of even charging a fee to get on the island when it's always been free.
I have to ask you, Sarah, and you can tell me if you did not hear this, but I did see a published reference by a reporter who tweeted from the hearings that Governor Snyder was referenced as Massa during about the first hour in. How much did that happen, and how much of that was happening during the public comments?
I did not hear that particular line at the public hearing, but I've heard that reported at, mm-hmm. you know, from multiple sources that did happen. It wouldn't be the first time that sort of inflammatory language was used. I've definitely heard it before referring to Governor Snyder. I mean, even Kwame Kenyatta, who's a member of the city council, saying, you know, that essentially the state and Governor Snyder view Detroit as a kind of plantation and that they have that sort of overseer mentality when it comes to the people and the affairs of the city. And that's a very strong vein of thought in certain groups of Detroiters.
Did anyone speak out in favor of this?
There were quite a few people who spoke out for it. The majority of the vocal opposition was against it, but it seemed that as the time for a vote drew near, that more people who were supportive of the idea of leasing Belle Isle to the state did come out and say, we support this idea. It's, you know, it may not be an ideal situation, but in terms of the situation Detroit's in right now, it's probably the best offer, the best thing we've got going. But ultimately, the council decided that, or majority of council members decided that there were just too many unanswered questions, and they didn't want to vote on it right now.
Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter, Sarah Swick. And just to recap, Governor Snyder's office announced that they are withdrawing the Belle Isle lease offer because the deal needed to be done by the end of this month in order to give the Department of Natural Resources time to do what they needed to do to get Belle Isle ready for the next season. What happens next to Belle Isle is unclear, but we will continue to follow this story. Let's turn now to antiquity. Imagine this. You fire up your iPad or iPhone and you swipe the screen to reveal a beautifully clear page from the 3rd century. The University of Michigan's most famous papyrus, Epistles of Paul, is actually available as an iPhone and iPad app. The app is called Picture It EP. Joining me now is Professor Arthur Verhaecht of the Department of Classical Studies at U of M. He helped develop this remarkable app. So, Professor, tell us first about this ancient text. It's one of the most famous in the university's collection, which is formidable, isn't it?
It is, yes. Indeed, the text is the most ancient manuscripts of the letters of St. Paul that exists in the world. And as such, it's providing some readings that didn't make it into the actual Bible. And some people made, indeed, some decisions that it shouldn't be in the Bible because it's just a different manuscript edition.
Huh.
But it dates to about 200 CE, and it is indeed the oldest manuscript of the letters of St. Paul in the world, and it dates about 200 years before the other manuscripts that take over the letters of St. Paul then.
Now, I have to ask you, because you used a phrase I've never heard before, and maybe our listeners haven't, when you said 200 CE. That's, we're used to AD.
Yes.
But what is CE?
CE means the common era. So that is the more modern way of saying AD. Indeed.
Okay.
And then the BC would be the BCE before the Common Era.
All right. Well, you've just enlightened a lot of us. So the idea behind this was based what? Was it because you had so many people wanting to see this? Clearly, this is such a precious text, you couldn't come hauling it out every time somebody wanted to peruse it.
That's correct indeed. So it is one of the most sought after texts in our collection. And about every week, there will be people coming into the papyrology rooms in the graduate library, knocking on the door, asking to see the letters of St. Paul. And we cannot do that. The texts are kept in a secured vault, and we cannot just bring these texts out for everybody just showing up. We often put them on display, but still that is not enough for those people who visit the University of Michigan and think, let's see it.
Yes.
So at that point, we started thinking, well, how can we make this text available? And they are already available online, but in a very static manner. So you can see the picture, you can see a description of the papyrus, but you don't have the interactive way of doing it. And then at that point, I started thinking, well, why, with now all the possibilities we have with all these apps and
there's
the technology.
There's an app for everything,
there's
right?
There's an app for everything, absolutely. So I thought, what if we can combine the technology that we have for flipping through books, but then make it an old book? And then the thing you will need, of course, is that, looking at a papyrus by itself will not tell you much, so you will need some extras. You need a translation, some annotations and things like that. So that's how we started. And then I contacted the university's UM 3D lab on North Campus, and we came together in a meeting and I told them, well, I want the following things. And then they came back to me and said, well, the following things are possible. And that's how it all started. And 8 months later, here we are.
So Picture It EP, and that's how Apple, so it's Picture It colon EP.
Correct.
That's how you'll find it in your iTunes store when you're checking your apps. I just put it on my iPad before, and it is absolutely stunning because of all the bells and whistles that you've built in. So give us a sense, our listeners, a sense of what they'll find.
Yeah, so what you will find if you start up after the welcoming page, you will see a book, basically. You see two pages of a book, or if you put it in the landscape mode, you will see one page of a book. And that is the papyrus itself. So it's the image of the papyrus. So you see the Greek text, and then you will notice there is no word division. There are no, even if you don't know Greek, you will be able to see it's just continuous, one smack of text. You also see it's somewhat damaged. And that's one of the interesting things. People in antiquity also lick their fingers when they flip the page. So most of the damage will be on the side where you flip the page. And that is indeed what you see.
I never thought of that, but you're absolutely right. It's the lower corners.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, and then if you want to know more, if you don't know Greek, then you can touch one of the buttons, bottoms on the top, and that will give you a very interactive translation. So, it will give four lines of translation. So it will follow your fingers on the page. And that translation was especially made for the app. So it's not providing the translation you've seen in the Bible, of that people might know from their Bible. We had a graduate student from the University of Birmingham who's writing his dissertation on this specific papyrus. So he had to translate the thing anyhow. And he was graciously accepted to just have us use this text. And it's a very literal translation. So we really want, because reading an ancient book was hard work. Again, you don't have word division. There's no punctuation, no nothing. So you really have to focus on what you're doing.
Yes.
And by giving you a translation which really makes you work, it's a difficult translation. I mean, it's not difficult in the sense that it's difficult words, but it's very literal. Challenging.
Well, I'm going to give our listeners an idea because I have it open in front of me, and just the page that I have, the line says, here's a translation. For I say by the grace, the one given to me, to everyone being among you, not to think more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, to each as the God assigned a measure of faith. So it's the fairly literal translation of the Greek?
Yes, definitely. And it also allows us to do it this literal, is that it is more or less one-on-one with the Greek text. So where your finger is on the page will also be what the Greek will tell you at that spot on the page.
Yes. And then you can also touch it, and there's the entire page translated. It takes away the Greek.
Yes.
And it's amazing, and explain to us, as someone who is a professor of papyrology in Greek, how is it that you're able to do these translations on these damaged texts? Is there some deduction? Do you kind of deduce what they're probably saying to make up for the parts that are missing on the page?
Yeah, no, that is correct. And of course, as in the case of the Epistles of Paul, the text is known, so we can just go to the bookshelf and get the text out as we know it. The thing, though, is that there are more than 100 spots in this papyrus where there is a different reading in the papyrus than what made it into the standard version of the New Testament. And that's what we also explain in the annotations. Then we say, well, the papyrus has this reading, and we either say, well, this was a scribal error.
Yes.
Didn't hear it correctly, or he didn't copy it correctly. Or we say, well, this is apparently a reading of the Bible that was going around in Egypt at that time, but didn't make it into the final version because somebody decided, nah, this is not correct.
Fascinating. It makes me wonder. And you think of that third century scribe who was there with his quill and working on that sheet of papyrus. What do you think he would say as he saw this amazing technology and saw his work married with, it's really marrying the world's most ancient text to the world's newest technology?
Yeah, I think he would have been thrilled. I mean, for 1800 years later, his work being available to the general audience, people can flip through it and really enjoy what he's been doing, because you're absolutely right. It was hard work. I mean, this is 104 sheets. So that's 208 pages of Greek, and as you can see on your app, they're quite full, the pages.
They're very full.
So that's definitely, it has been hard work. So I think he would undoubtedly have enjoyed this and the fact that we can now enjoy his work. And it's not this one person who in antiquity was able to read this book, because it was, we don't know where it was, sure, either in the library or in the monastery or whatever, but only a couple of people will have had access to it. Mm-hmm. And now we have, well, several, perhaps thousands of people who will be able to read his work. So I think he will have enjoyed it immensely.
And your sense, if you will, of the reward or the appeal to non-scholars of being able to have this app?
Yeah, so I think it is very rewarding for non-scholars to be able to see this and especially to touch it. That's I think, because as usual, as people who go to museums know, you're, well, unless you're going to the Ann Arbor Hands-On Museum, but otherwise you're not allowed to touch the objects.
Right.
And that's the same for ancient papyri, for art objects and things like that. But this, and it's giving a very lifelike. I mean, this is really how the text looks like, but it allows you to touch, it allows you to read by touching the text as well. So, I mean, it is my hope that the audience will really enjoy this app. And that's the word, enjoy the app indeed, and enjoy reading this papyrus.
I would suspect this has probably opened more ideas and conversations about putting more texts available.
Absolutely,
this
yes.
What's next?
I've been thinking about a paleography of Greek papyri. So the study of the handwriting of the papyri from, say, the 4th century BCE, before the Common Era, to the 9th century CE. So that for 10 centuries, so for 1,000 years, we have Greek handwriting on papyrus. And then give very telling examples of the different handwritings that we see. And then allow, with these several overlays that we have, give the Greek text, give a description, show the very nice features of each handwriting that we have. And again, the University of Michigan Papyrus Collection, it's very broad. So our oldest text is 1200 BCE, and our latest text, or our youngest text, is in 9th century CE. So we have the material on campus, and we now have the technology and the people who can help us doing it in making that available.
It makes it, I have to say, just as someone who's flipping through this now, it makes it real in a way that thinking about it or looking at something behind the glass at a museum where you, as you say, you can't touch, it really makes it real. And it also gets you thinking about that scribe who probably spent years in the monastery doing that calligraphy and carrying those words forward. And it is a good thing, and I'm sure that's why you're in classical studies, to help us draw the connections between us in 2013 and what was happening, you know, centuries and centuries ago.
Yes, absolutely. You're correct in that. And of course, I mean, it's not the same antiquity, but there are a lot of things were the same. I mean, people were writing letters in the collection. We have this wonderful letter from a Roman soldier writing home to his mom that he had just enlisted in the fleet. And he says, "Don't worry, mom, I'm okay. I will be enlisted on the fleet." And he sent that letter home from Rome to Egypt, to a village where the excavators in the 1920s found this letter in a house. So there his mother must have stored his house as a treasure of her son. And I think that's a thing that is similar quite now. There's mothers who have their sons in Afghanistan at the moment, and they're waiting for their email, their Skype contact. And, well, in antiquity, they had papyrus letters they could send home.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
That might be a good way to summarize it.
Professor, thanks for joining us today on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
As always, thank you so much for joining us today on Stateside on this Tuesday, a day when weather forecasters say parts of our state will meet or beat high temperature records. The Detroit area could reach highs today of 58. That would tie the record set in 1914 for this day. And tomorrow's temperatures are expected to top the record of 53 degrees, a record set in 1969. Areas in the Thumb region could see record highs as well. Strong south winds and a big, strong jet stream are bringing in the higher temps and precipitation. But don't put your winter coat away, because it is back to winter with snowflakes and cold temps by Thursday. Grand Rapids, you only get to 17 on Friday. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow afternoon at 3.
Thank you. Give me a second to print out the promo.